Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Rachel. It's nice to see you.
Good to see you. What's on your mind today?
Well, this week, like everyone, I'm thinking about Thanksgiving and how different everything is at this moment. And for the first time in my entire life, I will not be spending Thanksgiving with more than 15 to 20 people, which has been our tradition forever. And for the first time in about 15 years, I won't be cooking Thanksgiving dinner for 17 people. It's actually just going to be my husband and myself. And I have two thoughts about that. One is that it scares me a little bit how happy I am that it's just going to be my husband and myself, and how used to the isolation and the solitude I've become and how comfortable it is. That is a concern, because as I talk about all the time, we are people of connections. And when we get too comfortable not being connected, it's hard to re-engage. So I'm thinking about that. But I'm also thinking about the story that is my family and how much I love that story, even in all the ways that it can be frustrating. And I know that usually at this time of year, I'd be having the conversation about how to navigate that family dinner, how to come with your best foot forward, how to look for positive things to talk about, how to engage the family without having conflict. You know, all of those kind of cheerleading things that I like to do to get people prepared to mingle with their family and to have a really positive experience. And our family gatherings, like everyone's, has their little nuances. You know, there's different alliances and people to get along better with each other than different parts of the group. And part of my thought in the coming week, my first thought was, I don't have to worry about navigating any of that this week. I don't have to, you know, worry about anyone's dynamic or anyone coming in a bad mood or anyone not, you know, having enough to eat. I don't have to worry about any of that. But as this week has progressed, or it's early in the week, but the last couple of weeks has progressed, and I'm starting to really look at the reality of Thursday, I'm sad that I'm not going to be navigating those conversations. Or for me, because I'm an eavesdropper by profession, I won't get to overhear the conversations that are being had between cousins, between my daughters and their aunts and uncles, with my parents, my husband and my brother, all those little relationships that have formed over the last, you know, 35, 40 years. I will miss that. And maybe it's a good thing that we're having a break. Maybe it's a good thing that a lot of us are having to pause on our holiday gatherings and not come together and rethink who we're going to spend Thanksgiving or Christmas with, because having this opportunity to pause is allowing me, and I'm sure a lot of you, a chance to find new gratitude for those people that we share a story with, those people that we share our holidays with, those people that we share our lives with. And so although I have those feelings of relief that I don't have to cook for 17 people, that I don't have to worry about cleaning my house, that it's nice to just kind of have some downtime, I have a much louder story in my head saying, you really need to rethink how much you value the time you get to spend with your family. You need to rethink how you gather and look at those family conversations, and mostly to rethink kind of the story of who we are as a family and what's important to us. Because the other piece that concerns me is that I'm a little relieved we're not having to do a big gathering, but I'm more concerned that the rest of my family is relieved that we're not having to do a big gathering, because they pack up their cars, they drive down here, they have to drag their teenagers who are saying the last thing I want to do is go to, you know, their house. So what happens next year when we have the all clear, if we get the all clear? What if the rest of my family says, you know what, it was kind of easier not having to pack up and come down and see you. And then our traditional family gathering loses its connection. Because this year is the anomaly. This year we're having to do things differently. But assuming that we go back to some semblance of gathering next year, what if we've all kind of taken this year, and instead of really missing and wanting to come back together, we start to say, you know, it was easier not having to hang out. Maybe we won't gather again. Maybe we won't come down for Thanksgiving. Maybe we won't make the effort to go over to grandma's for Christmas. And that concerns me, because if we don't hang on to those traditions, we start to lose that fabric that connects us as human beings. And again, I'm thinking of my own thought process. I don't think that that is something that's unique to me. That I think a lot of us are finding an odd comfort in being alone, kind of missing our families or madly missing our families, but then we might get used to this normal of not being together, and we'll have to recalibrate our holidays moving forward. So it's not a real direct thought this week. It's not something that's really whole or encapsulated, but I think the whole idea of the story of our family has been on my mind. And when I think of the story of my family or stories in general, I think of narrative therapy, which I don't know a lot about. It's not my area of expertise, but it is a form of psychotherapy that's been around since the 1980s. And it is a strength-based therapy that, just in the most general form, looks at our lives as a culmination of the stories we tell and believe about ourselves, who we are, how we engage with the world. And we develop the story about who we are by the interactions we have with people in our lives, different experiences and relationships and events that influence how we see ourselves and then how we again respond and react. And so you can imagine that throughout the course of our life, if we have positive interactions and positive reinforcement, then that story we tell about ourselves would be a positive story, that we would see ourselves as someone of value and worth and spread that positivity. But you can also imagine that if you have negative interactions, toxic interactions, traumatic interactions, negative experiences with our families, then you would carry that story in a whole different way. And so I thought, I'm going to connect with someone I know who is an expert in narrative therapy, because I want to talk about the danger in, one, getting too comfortable, not being together as families, and all of a sudden those stories that might be flawed start to become bigger stories, right? If we don't spend time with our family, those things that might have been negatives before can get blown out of proportion, just as when things are we don't get to see someone, we remember the good things may be blown out of proportion. So how can we start thinking about families and connections and our stories as we move forward through the pandemic, forward through the holidays? So today I have a guest, Tom Andre, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist with an expertise in narrative therapy. And we're going to kind of talk about how he found his way to becoming a clinician, and also why he chose narrative therapy, and then what that looks like in dealing with families and individuals. And because we aren't having the phone lines open as usual, you can still ask a question, make a comment by giving us a call at 805-549-8855. I am Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can also reach me by sending an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast our show. Anywhere that you get your podcast, just hit subscribe and it will upload to your device. And you can follow us on Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. I actually have a photo of our family at one of our previous Thanksgiving gatherings, if you'd like to check that out, or on Facebook, A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. As always, I look forward to seeing where this conversation takes us. We'll take a quick break and we'll be back to start our conversation with Tom Andre. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
I don't feel the sun's coming out today. I'm staying in, it's gonna find another way. As I sit here in this misery, I don't think I'll ever know, Lord, seen the sun from here. Knows I've been away. They'll all look at me and say, and they'll say, hey, look at him. I'll never live that way. That's all.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And my guest today is Tom Andre. Tom is a licensed marriage and family therapist. He's been working in El Segundo for 4 years. He works with families, couples, and individuals, and takes a special interest in the ways things that happen during our teens and early 20s, how they reverberate throughout our lives. Tom actually didn't start his professional career in the world of psychotherapy. He worked for over a decade in entertainment and media, including executive positions at Turner Broadcasting, Paramount, and Sony Pictures. And prior to that, he produced a music festivals in Brazil and Colombia. Tom is originally from New Orleans and has lived in Los Angeles since 2006. He has a master's degree from Phillips Graduate University and a bachelor's degree from Princeton University. And now he is trained as a narrative therapist. And Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor to be here.
So I never quite know where I want to start with this. Like, right off the top, do I say, let me tell you how I met Tom. He's friends with my brother. They both worked in the entertainment world together. I would assume it was somewhere around the Paramount or Sony Pictures time.
Sony, yeah. It was Sony we met.
And my brother called me probably 5 or 6 years ago and said, hey, my buddy Tom is thinking of changing careers. He's going to drop out of the entertainment world and become a psychotherapist. And he wants to talk to you about it. And so we had this great conversation in my backyard. And now here you are 5 years later, a licensed clinician. So talk a bit about your trajectory before making a switch. Like, you went to Princeton. The world was your oyster. What did you do with it?
Oh, that's a... Oh, no. That's actually a really... for me, it was more of a weight, I think, than anything else. I think there's so much expectation attached to having sort of a degree from a prestigious university. At least there was for me. A lot of people I was with sort of had paths laid out for them through people who they knew who had gone there before or connections that they made. That was never really something that I was interested in. A lot of people from my class went into investment banking and consulting, and those were never fields that appealed to me. And so I kind of graduated with this you know, prestigious degree and felt a bit lost. I took a PR job in New York City, and I quit that after less than a year and went to do kind of traveling around South America for working on a website at the time, kind of talking to tourism companies and trying to convince them to sign up. And that was much more exciting to me than sitting behind a desk and filling out spreadsheets. At the same time, you have this kind of nagging, well, you've got this degree, you've got to do something with it. You've got to do something big. You've got to do something prestigious in a way, or make a lot of money. And so I always had this kind of conflict inside. Well, I don't care that much about this, but that wasn't really something that I was ready to admit to myself at that point. And so I, you know, tried to figure out the coolest thing that I could do at the time when you're, you know, 23, 24 and don't have a family, don't have a lot tying you down. So I started a music festival in Rio because that was just bringing New Orleans musicians to Rio was kind of the coolest thing I could think of at the time. And that worked for a couple of years. I never got rich doing it, but I really enjoyed the work. And I think we did some cool things with wonderful people that I met, and I'm happy to have done that. And as you know, which has a connection to therapy in the sense of there was a time when I was moderating a conversation, kind of a fight between two friends, and they were really having an argument, and I was sort of in the middle. And one of them said to me years later, you know, you should be a therapist. I still remember that time where you were standing between us and, you know, you were just fair to both of us. And that was, you know, I think you missed your calling. And it took me hearing that from someone else to really even consider this line of work. And then as I was in my first year looking at for a traineeship, I reached out to a clinic called Miracle Mile Community Practice here in Los Angeles. And I sat down with the director, who's been a wonderful mentor ever since, David Marston. And I realized at the time, I don't know if this is the kind of therapy that I necessarily want to pursue, but this is an opportunity to work with someone who is really at the top of the field. And I thought, this is going to challenge me. And then the people who were working there at the time was a really special group of folks who I'm close with today. And I had met them and I thought, yeah, this is going to be something that I want to pursue. And I think I'm on board with this way of the world.
But you're jumping so quick, as typical men would do.
That was maybe so.
You jump through all the good parts of the story, because I have two questions. One, you grew up in New Orleans, and so going to Princeton wasn't your feeder school. So that must have been a big deal that you even applied and went. I mean, were you kind of pushed by your family? Why did you decide to go? That's one. And then before you jump too far away from that, when you were doing the music festival piece and doing that work, did it feel like you had accomplished or lived up to that Princeton pressure? So those are my two side questions.
Yeah, the first one, yeah, I think I was pushed gently. I was encouraged. You know, I don't know how things are now. I don't know that I would get in again today. They were always looking for people from all 50 states. And being from Louisiana made it much easier. Your test scores didn't have to be quite so good. You know, your grades maybe didn't have to be quite so good as the other people from, you know, New York, California, New Jersey, Connecticut. So I applied early and got in. I thought I would have better chances that way. And at that point in life, you think, well, okay, I apply to the school. If I get in, then you can write your own ticket, right? Then, you know, I don't know why I really want to go there, but it's got a really good name, so I should if I can get in. And that was sort of the conventional wisdom at the time. And you hear that again and again from, you know, it is a world that tells you, yes, you can do anything you want to do. And so maybe that told me in some ways that I could just go do a music festival.
Right. Because that doesn't seem like the common, because you kind of said it like, so I thought I would start a music festival. And in my head, I'm thinking that's not something most people are going to say. When I look at my job options, starting a music festival wouldn't be the first thing. So you had to have some confidence or some.
It was actually more desperation.
Was it?
Yeah. In the sense of like, I could not, you know, I would look at the careers of people, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ahead of me, and I could not find anything that I wanted to do. Now, I hadn't been exposed to that much either. And I thought, okay, well, I don't know what options are available to me, but this sounds kind of cool. I think I have a pretty good sense of what a good time is. Growing up in New Orleans, I used to go to Jazz Fest. My dear mother let me skip school once or twice and go hang out on a Thursday afternoon. And then I had visited Brazil studying abroad, and I just fell in love with the culture. And I thought this is kind of like a different version of New Orleans in so many different ways. And so I thought, well, what if we bring them together? Has anybody done that? And on maybe a micro level, people had. And so I thought it was a product of a lot of thinking and a lot of, okay, what can I do? And a lot of stress, like just what am I going to do with my life? What am I going to do with it? How long can I keep just kicking the can down the road? I've got to focus on something. And so I thought, well, I don't know where it's going to go. If it takes off, if it does really well, you know, by some chance, then wow, great, what a life. If not, then I'll go back and figure out something else to do at some point. I think that was my calculation at the time.
And isn't that the great thing about being young, Tom, is that your lifespan feels endless. And so there's a lot of can kicking you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine when did you come out to LA? Cause then things shifted and you ended up at Paramount and Sony where you met my brother. How did that switch happen?
That switch happened with Katrina. I was kind of dividing my time between New Orleans and Brazil. And I guess if there's anyone, young listeners out there, Katrina was a big hurricane that hit New Orleans about 15 years ago. Not everyone remembers that.
True. That is
but
true.
I was about 6 weeks away from producing another festival in New Orleans, kind of a smaller one, together with Tulane University. And Katrina swept through and drowned the city, and that obviously wasn't going to happen. And I had no idea what I was going to do next. And I landed on my brother's couch in Los Angeles, got a job with Sony Pictures, ended up working with a dear friend, someone who became a dear friend and mentor, and was the other person who pushed me or encouraged me to become a therapist. And so it was very serendipitous in that sense. And that was even years later. But so I got a job as an assistant at Sony Pictures.
You're the coffee guy.
The coffee guy with a, and this was a lesson that I learned, with a boss who was interested in bringing people up, interested in helping people below her. And I'm, you know, forever grateful for that. Her name is Gina Kilberg. She was great. She introduced me to your brother. And we became good friends, and she became a therapist and said, you should think about doing the same thing. And that was the second person who had told me that. And I thought, okay, I'll think about doing this. And then I looked into it and here I am.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to my guest, Tom Andre. He is a licensed marriage and family therapist specializing in narrative therapy down in Los Angeles. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And I invited Tom on because I wanted to talk about stories and the narrative that really propels all of our lives, that we all are just living out a myth, a mythology, a hero's journey, a story that is the culmination of things that happened in our lives. And Tom's talking about kind of those things that happened serendipitously that brought him to the field of psychotherapy. And although we're not taking calls, if you have a comment or question, our number is 805-549-8855, and Rachel will be happy to read your question over the air. So you're building this narrative, Tom, that, you know, kind of finding your way, you're young, you're confident, you have opportunities. So you don't seem, it doesn't sound like you're too panicked. You end up, you know, working for Sony, but you get this message and you keep hearing about being a therapist. Had you gone to therapy? Did you have mental health things? Because most people in our profession don't just say, hey, that sounds interesting, like, right? Usually there's some personal things that finally open that door.
Yeah, I hadn't done much at all. I had gone to maybe a few meetings before taking this step. So that made me a little bit nervous joining the group of others who had done this. You know, and there's a lot of people, and I can't really contradict them, who'll say you can't be effective in this job if you haven't done your own work. And of course, you know, having done this, I have, of course, but it was a bit of a leap of faith. I think you do get to a certain age or a certain point in your life when you have a few, you have a little bit of mileage on you, and you realize that, you know, life experience is going to count for something, and that, you know, if you have experience as a good listener, then you may be able to do the job. And so I took the leap of faith, and I've loved it. I've loved every minute of it.
So how did you choose? You went to Phillips, and it's not a program that I'm familiar with. How did you choose that?
Because I could work full time and study there. So it was all day on Saturdays, and then Wednesday nights. So so I could do that. And it was a very tough time. I had a newborn and a new job and starting school all the same week. So that was difficult and even harder on my wife, I think, because she never got to be away from the baby.
Well, and it's all encompassing, the training to be a therapist, your 3,000 hours you have to do supervised before you even get licensed. And I remember when we first talked, you know, you were talking about what your dreams were as a clinician, with kind of this vision you had for how you could provide mental health care to people. And do you still have that same vision for how you see yourself going in, as a clinician?
Yeah, I think it's going to evolve, hopefully, my whole career. I think your interests change as your life experience changes, for sure. I've got a lot of ideas still bandying about in my head. I've just started my own practice since June, and I've been fortunate to have sort of been mentored and work with really wonderful people who have helped me along every step of the way. I do have strong ideas about what I want to do in the next couple of years. It's kind of a combination of establishing a thriving practice, but also, you know, how can we help people who don't have a chance as much to access mental health? There's a huge need, obviously, out there, and it's important for all of us, I think, you know, especially if you're coming from a place of privilege, to think, you know, what are you going to do with that privilege? And it's funny, you know, going back to thinking about Princeton and the work that people do to get into these schools, I don't recall anyone ever asking, and I think there should be one question in the admissions question, which is, you know, if you have the privilege to go to a place like this, what are you going to do with it? How are you going to use it? And I think people don't think about that enough. And so I forget about it sometimes too, and try to remind myself. But I think I have this idea, and I'm just kind of riffing here a little bit, but the idea of becoming, I want to say, like a public therapist, where people can call you or just sign up for a one-time meeting that come in, I need to talk to someone. And then your job is also to explain what's happening in the community and explain what's happening in the world. And this is a little bit about narrative therapy principles, in the sense that we don't look at the work as finding what might be wrong with an individual. I think you have to start with what's happening in the world and how might one be expected to feel based on what's happening in the world. The metaphor I use is, if you're standing on a beach and suddenly you see a tsunami coming at you, what are you supposed to feel? Are you supposed to be happy and positive all the time, or are stress and anxiety completely appropriate responses? And so, you know, the idea of a public therapist would be someone who could, you know, kind of give a talk. Hey, this is happening. These are real things that are happening in our community, in our country, in our world. If you're experiencing stress and anxiety, it's probably
join the club.
Not just you. Yeah.
I picture Lucy, you know, sitting at her table, the Peanuts character. And I often feel like that when I am out walking, which again goes back to the eavesdropper part of my personality. But I have felt like I've practiced a sort of public therapy for quite a long time, because I talk to people whenever I see them out walking, or if I see a mom struggling in the store, and I'll stop and I'll say, you're doing such a great job. This is such hard work you're doing. Like, I feel that part of my license is filled with responsibility to, like you, check in with everyone in my community, whether they're really asking for it or not. Because if we don't stop and acknowledge people and their struggles, then we're putting therapy in this little capsule that can only happen in a tiny room with another person. And I think what you're saying is you want to magnify, almost like a music festival, the opportunities for people to have a communal experience, a communal mental health experience. Hey, if you're feeling freaked out, come to this freaked out festival, because we're all feeling it right now.
Absolutely. And to your point, I think, you know, the idea of the let's go in a little room, let's meet once a week, that really serves the therapist probably more than the client. Is once a week necessarily the right amount of time to meet? I don't know. I mean, it's not horrible in most cases, and people build their schedules around what I do every week usually. But, you know, if you can come in and in one meeting get a great deal of work done, great. That's wonderful. Sometimes it's just, yeah, you're not alone in this. Mm-hmm. Yes, this stress, this anxiety, these things that you're feeling, there is a very good reason you're feeling them. And they go, yeah, go ahead.
Well, because in some way, and of course, it's said often that there is a bit of the spiritual, you know, religion part of the therapist, that we're dealing with the soul, the psyche of individuals. And so I can imagine we do like therapy church, where you're up on the, you know, standing on the strand down on Manhattan Beach and gathering people around and saying, let's talk how your mental health is. Hey, how are you feeling? And you've got all these people together. You know, it sounds a little bit crazy and you probably would be dragged away from it, but I see that as a great way of opening mental health care up in a way that serves a community and not just this business model. Because I think what you're describing is we created therapy to mimic what we see as the Western model of how we do business. We have appointments and a schedule, and you come every 50 minutes and then we move to the next person. But that wasn't necessarily designed because it was the most therapeutic.
Right. We're trying to, we follow the medical model in therapy, trying to fix people, trying to identify a mental disorder that they have, as opposed to identifying the problems that are acting on people and working with them to figure out how they want to respond to these problems. Instead, we put all of the responsibility and all of the weight and all of the duty to change, to become normal, on an individual. And so, you know, we're trying to get into their heads and help them change their thoughts, whereas maybe they would be better served, at least according to what they believe, by struggling against whatever forces might be oppressing them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Not internal, but the external pressures.
Absolutely.
My guest is Tom Andre. He's a licensed marriage and family therapist specializing in narrative therapy. He's been practicing for 4 years in the Los Angeles area. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number, if you have a question or comment, is 805-549-8855. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk about what narrative therapy looks like and how you can start applying some of those principles to your own experiences with those you love and who you are attached to. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
If a picture paints a thousand words, then why can't I paint you? The words will never show the you I've come to know. If a face could launch a thousand ships, then where am I to go? There's no one home but you. You're all that's left me to. And when yourself on me.
tomorrow and today beside you all the way. If the world should stop revolving, spinning slowly down to die, I'd spin.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest is Tom Andre, and Tom and I met through my brother about 5 years ago. They worked in similar industries in Sony Pictures down in Los Angeles, and Tom decided he wanted to shift his career path, that he wanted to do something that felt, I'm speaking for you now, Tom, so you can jump in and interrupt me, but wanted to do something that felt like it had more weight to it, felt like it was making more of a difference in the world.
And yes. Absolutely. I felt like I didn't want to look back on my life at all of the transactions I had facilitated between one business and another. That didn't feel like it was particularly meaningful to me. And, you know, there's plenty of people for whom that's great and that's wonderful. But having been exposed over the course of life to other ideas and other possibilities of ways to dedicate your time. For me, that wasn't what I valued. I thought it would be, I would be most content if I could look back on my life at having helped people in some way.
Well, and I like that you mentioned, and I hope it's a kind of an inspiration for other people, that a couple people along the way said to you, hey, you're a great listener. This might be something you'd be good at. And that if we paid attention to those others, who even strangers who noticed something about us and kind of brought that in, that it would help change the way we see ourselves and hence our story, which goes along with the focus of therapy you chose, which is narrative therapy. And I know a lot of people are familiar with psychoanalysis or cognitive behavioral therapy. Those are very popular right now. But I don't know if a lot of people understand narrative. And so can you talk a bit about what narrative looks like and why you chose that as opposed to, you know, focusing on CBT or EMDR or mindfulness?
Sure. So the short version of narrative therapy is that we take the position that the problem is what we're going to focus on in our work and not the person as a problematic individual. And what that means is that a person who's contending with worry, for example, can focus on the abilities they already possess as they face their worry, as opposed to feeling that there's something wrong with them for worrying all the time. It also, when you're working with a family, means that the family can focus on the worry and what contributes to the worry and what diminishes the worry, instead of focusing on the person as a worry wart, which tends to also bring more shame into the equation. And the same would go for anger or self-doubt. And, you know, if a problem is part of who we are, then when we turn against it, we're kind of turning against ourselves. Instead, if we think that problems are something that we want to change our relationship with, then we can actually take action against them without losing who we are. At the same time, I think at least most of us act rationally most of the time. And when something's harmful to us, there's usually something appealing about it. You know, for example, if you take drinking, or if you take skydiving, we should acknowledge that these are not, that there's often a more complicated story behind most problems. And the idea is to really never bring shame into the therapy process. I think that's really important.
Because one of the two most common things that walk into the therapist's office are depression and anxiety. And my understanding of narrative is that the first thing people tend to do is say, my anxiety or my depression. They take ownership of these symptoms as if it is who they are. I'm depressed or I'm anxious. And so what I'm hearing you say is, the narrative therapist, you separate it out. It's like you're you who's experiencing depression. And so the problem is external from you.
Correct. Right. Absolutely. And especially with depression and anxiety, I often say, let's not even worry about depression or anxiety at this point, because so often those are become self-fulfilling prophecies. People feel anxiety about feeling anxiety, or depressed that they're depressed. I think depression and anxiety are more often than not symptoms of other problems. They're the result of other things that are happening in our lives. And those other things that are happening in our lives are often things that we can address. You know, even if you can't solve a certain problem, it's something that you can, maybe together with a therapist or together with people who you care about, face. And once you do that, often anxiety really tends to diminish or even slip away.
Or it just becomes the way we move through the world, but it doesn't present as a problem. Because right when we were young, or I remember my grandma would say, you said a worrywart, you know, so a worrywart is a much different thing than someone who now has a diagnosis of generalized anxiety disorder.
Absolutely.
It's just all in the story that we tell as a culture about who people are. It goes back to that kind of narrative, that social construct. And when someone is told all their life, you have generalized anxiety disorder, that's a very different story than saying, oh, you're a worrywart, but that's just part of who you are, right?
Yes. And, you know, it's funny, you know, with a diagnosis, narrative therapists often are reluctant to give a diagnosis. Some people really feel relief if they receive a diagnosis. Oh, this is what I have. This is what almost as if I've caught this thing. And I understand that in the sense of it really does provide solidarity and say, okay, this is a thing that's out there. This is something that a lot of people experience. A lot of people have identified this set of feelings. This reaction is normal, which is a word I really don't like very much. But I think, you know, wanting to know that you're not the only one experiencing something, I think, is really important.
But then the diagnosis becomes this weight.
That's the flip side. It becomes a weight, and it goes on your medical records, and then you think, well, I have this thing. You know, maybe it's not curable. Maybe there, you know, there is something wrong with me. I have this diagnosis. You don't have this diagnosis, and so I don't think it's particularly valuable to seek a diagnosis out with people. I think let's focus on the problems that are coming into people's lives and address those.
So as a narrative therapist, when, you know, someone comes in for therapy, we'll just like bring it home here. Most people would expect I call a therapist, I make an appointment, I come and I tell them all of my problems, saturated stories, and then they fix me or heal me or help me think differently, which would be CBT. What would be different in the narrative therapist's office?
Sure. We're not looking for any one, certainly technique to change the way people think. Narrative therapists ask a lot of questions. I think basically it's almost all we do in some ways. And then we'll pause and make a speech sometimes about everything that's happening in society, in solidarity with the effects that problems have on people. But what we like to do is listen for exceptions to the problem saturated story. So if you come in with a problem and, you know, a lot of the time, the way we think of our lives is, you know, this event happened and this event happened and this event happened and this event happened and they're connected in this way. And this, and the way that they're connected is the narrative of the story. How do we connect, you know, childhood trauma to trauma later in life or to problems later in life. So often our social norms will dictate what that story is to us. And as we're listening to someone tell their story, we're listening for times when they pushed back against this dominant story about them. We're listening for times when they said, you know what, I don't think I'm in agreement with the story that anger wants to tell about me. You could tell, you know, anger could tell a story of, here, I'm a guy who beat somebody up and beat somebody up and beat somebody up. And therefore I am an angry, violent person. And we're listening for the times when anger wasn't there. And we're curious of why anger wasn't there and what a person values that kept anger apart or kept anger away. We're listening for stories about, what is important to people and what they have done or intend to do or hope they can do in service of those things that are important to them. And then hopefully over time, we construct a story not based on fiction, but based on facts and events and beliefs that is more serving of the person that's come to meet us.
You know, it just makes me, and if you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest is Tom Andre, licensed marriage and family therapist. And time goes so fast because I want to make sure we talk a little bit about those family narratives as we're coming into the holidays. But I had this vision of a child who, from the time they're young, is told they have ADHD, they have ADHD. And it just is so upsetting to me when parents refer to their children as, you have ADHD. That's a whole nother show that I want you to come back so we can talk about, because that's a whole attitude. Because if we said to that child from the time they were young, you are brilliant putting these Legos together, you don't sit still because you always have something exciting that you want to explore, like, that's the same child with a different focus, and that would be life-changing. So I'm gonna placehold that, because we're going to come back to it. But with the rest of our time, I want to talk about that story of families who might be saying, I'm glad I don't have to gather with everyone, because whenever we're together, you know, Uncle Bob drinks too much, and then we have an argument about politics, and then so the family story is already set in stone before anyone even arrives for turkey. So how do we help people to switch that narrative before they even show up?
Well, you know, one thing that I love to talk about families with is, you know, what their particular values are as a family. What are things that are important to them? What are things that maybe do bind them together? And I think most people tend to, you know, even if their politics are totally different, if you really back up, you know, do you value your health? Do you value kindness? Do you value listening? I think there's so many of these things that we don't give enough attention to, that we can spend a little more time building up, especially among families. Hey, we are a family of good listeners. We are a family of people who enjoy laughing. We are a family of people who like to take care of their children. We are a family of people who enjoy being together. We are huggers. Whatever it is, really slowing down and focusing on things that you can all agree on, I think is a good way to start.
You know, because I imagine the exercise for people who aren't gathering with their families is to do a little of that narrative work, which is to actually write the story down. Starting with, and what do you suggest, Tom? You know, do you, because in my head, the first thing is you write down the toxic story and just give it a place to live so you can move it aside. Do you write that narrative down and then make space for the new narrative? Or do we just ignore the negative narrative, which is more healing?
I think if we ignore the negative narrative or the story that's full of problems that we don't like, we are insulting our own intelligence in some ways. I think it's there. But I think our job as therapists and the people who come to work with therapists, our job and the work in the room that we do together is to challenge that story, to write another version based on values, based on a person's preferred way of telling it. Because we can't just toss away the world we live in and the story that the world we live in is going to try to channel us to. We can't just toss away the story that we've been telling ourselves. But we can come up with another version that is absolutely as true and absolutely as valid. And then you say, yeah, I actually prefer to tell a story about all the nice things that I did in my life as opposed to all of the mean things. And then we'll recruit witnesses and people who's, yeah, I saw this person do this nice thing. It meant this to me. And so now all of a sudden, you know, a person or a family has more than one available story to them.
And
it's really important.
And we have to keep I want to keep reiterating that everything about our lives are just a story, whatever that story is, whether it's the cultural story or whether it's our religious story that we grew up with, or whether it's our educational story we grew up with. We're all just a culmination of whatever story it is we choose to believe in that moment. And unfortunately, so many people choose to be engrossed in the negative story. And I don't know, you know, if that's just our human nature, is that we are drawn to the dark quickly, that it takes a lot more effort and concentration to focus on the things that are going well. But when it comes to kind of the pandemic narrative of everything is horrible and we're locked up and we have to wear masks, you know, that's a problem saturated story that is holding us back from being able to thrive. It's all a story.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one thing you said that I thought was interesting, we choose these problem stories. I'm not sure I agree that we choose them. I think we often get pushed into them by others. You know, I think, especially in COVID, American culture loves to elevate self-reliance as an important value. We love our bootstrap stories. You know, you build a log cabin, you build a business, and then, you know, we start to feel inadequate if we're not feeling great all the time. And, you know, the pandemic is kind of pushing us all into our own little corners when it is exactly the time where we should be reaching out to people. And that's really hard to do. And you know, we have to be connected. Otherwise, we're going to get comfortable and miserable at the same time.
Well, I think that's where I kind of started the show today, was I have this conundrum of part of me is a little relieved that I'm not cooking for 17 people and kind of monitoring the things that annoy me about the 17 people. And then at the same time, that scared me, because if I get too comfortable not having to engage with my 17 people, how will I ever get myself back to them?
A lot of the work that I do, and I think most narrative therapists do, is we kind of ask, is it worth it? And we live in that world where, yeah, not everything is 100% one way or the other. And I suspect that, you know, if I ask you, is it a pain to cook Thanksgiving dinner for 20 people? You're going to say, yeah. And I'm going to say, is it worth it? And you're going to go, yeah. And maybe one year you're going to enjoy not having to do it and appreciate that. But you're going to think, yeah, okay, there's going to be the stress, all these people coming over. And then you take a deep breath and you go, but it's worth it.
And that is such a great line. Maybe that becomes what's on our mantle in everyone's home. It's worth it.
Yeah, I think so.
Like at the end of the day, it's worth it, because that's why we're here. It's why you went from putting on music festivals or working for Sony to going through years of schooling and not making as much money as you did, I would imagine.
Nope. No.
To doing this work, would you say your journey has been worth it?
It's absolutely worth it. So far, it is today. You know, maybe a few years from now, you'll ask me, and it won't have been. But as of now, it's definitely worth it.
So how have you changed? Who is Tom today, as opposed to who Tom was 5-10 years ago? Have you changed?
It's much easier for me to say, I'm not interested in these things that maybe I was supposed to be interested in. You know, when it comes to business, for example, I felt like I had to pretend to be interested in business. I'm not good at it. I don't like it. I'm not interested in it. And I can say that now, and it feels great. Maybe that's age too.
But I don't know, because I think, and again, another conversation, because these hours go so quickly, there's a lot of gendered speak in there, because as a man, how dare you say you're not interested in business?
Also true. Yeah, absolutely.
And so would your wife say that where you are now as a family has been worth the change?
I think she would. I think she definitely would. There was a couple jobs that I did that she really hated for me. And maybe hated me too, but.
Well, and then it goes to the narrative, right? Is it Tom you're hating, or is it the story of Tom in that moment?
Yeah. Well, I think we always feel it when we're not acting in ways that are consistent with who we want to be. Mm-hmm.
And who we were meant to be.
Yeah, that's right.
Thomas, hour went too fast.
I agree.
So if people are interested in, you know, because we're doing teletherapy now, how can they contact you? Because finding male clinicians is tough today.
Sure. It's they can email me at tom@tomandrecounseling.com, or they can text or call me at 310-776-5299. I have a website. It's tomandrecounseling.com. They can make an appointment there too.
Excellent. And you can always send an email to me, Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, and I can connect you with Tom. You can listen to previous shows or this show at kcbx.org. Please subscribe to our podcast, share it with your friends, follow us on Instagram, Facebook. Find a way to really look at your story. What is the story you tell yourself every day? And is it serving you and your mental health? And if not, how can you rewrite that? And we'll continue this conversation in the weeks to come. As always, I appreciate you supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.